President Trump's tariffs are extensive, complex, unprecedented. Are they legal? A series of courts are about to decide, and that's what we're going to talk about today on this episode of Independent Outlook. Hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you from Independent Institute in Oakland, California, where we try to provide an independent take on the issues of the day. For today's discussion, I'm joined by my colleague, Dr. Philip Magnus, who is a senior fellow and holds our David J. Thoreau Chair in Political Economy. Great to have you, Phil.
Happy to be here.
I'm also joined by my colleague, Dr. Williamson Ever, director of our Center for Educational Excellence. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you for having me.
Both of these gentlemen are well-versed in economics and law, and Philip is especially knowledgeable about tariffs in theory, practice, and history. So let's start with you. So, Phil, the legal case against President Trump's tariff seems like it's ultimately headed to the Supreme Court. In the meanwhile, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit has allowed the president's tariffs to remain in effect while it takes up the case. Phil, can you explain, for starters, what case and question are precisely before the Court of Appeals now?
Well, the case before the court is about the constitutionality of Trump's, basically his entire tariff program. So back in the spring when he enacted tariffs on his so-called Liberation Day, he did so basically by executive order. And the legal background here is it was a very unusual move based on how previous presidents have handled tariffs. Because there are certain carve-outs in U.S. trade law that allow the president to enact tariffs in certain emergency circumstances. So for example, if they meet national security criteria. There are also carve-outs that say if a foreign country is found to be targeting or dumping on the U.S. economy in a certain industry, the president can enact retaliatory tariffs. And I may disagree with some of these policies, but they're pretty well-established parts of U.S. trade law. Trump threw all that out the window.
So, Graham, just to make sure our listeners know, dumping means?
Oh, explain dumping, Phil.
Yeah, so it's basically a tactic, or it's an alleged tactic more than anything, where a foreign country tries to bury an industry in the United States by flooding its market with cheap goods.
Okay. Usually subsidized by their own government.
Exactly. It's claimed, it's like a foreign government is trying to give advantage to their own industry, or at least that's what the allegation is. And therefore, they subsidize a domestic industry in their own country to flood the U.S. with cheap imports and therefore put their competitors out of business.
So you're saying that that kind of thing has been authorized by congressional action in the past.
It has.
We're talking about a whole new range of things.
Entirely. So there were well-recognized, longstanding laws, and they were also built into the international agreements. Not always used in the best way. But Trump came along. He doesn't like those laws because they're politically difficult to navigate and they impose regulatory burdens on him. So, for example, to prove a dumping case, he has to have a regulatory review and an investigation. And his power's constrained where he can only target industries that specifically meet that. Same thing with national security. It has restrictions on it and it's subject to congressional oversight. So all of these clauses that exist in U.S. trade law come with a price tag of having to meet the regulatory obligations that Congress has set out to enact them. Trump doesn't like that because he just wants to rule by executive decree. So what he did is he turned to a completely different statute. It's called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977. And this act, even though it's existed on the books, it doesn't even mention the word tariffs or any synonym. It doesn't appear anywhere in the text of the act. But Trump has claimed through inference and interpretation that he can use this emergency decree measure to impose basically any economic policy that he desires, including up to rewriting the entire tariff schedule of the United States for every other country on earth. So starting around this April Liberation Day, and there were a few preceding orders, he started to invoke declarations of emergency, claiming that we have a trade imbalance, and that constitutes suddenly an emergency.
We've had a trade imbalance for years.
Exactly, for decades. It's more or less been the norm for the past 50 years and hasn't been an emergency, but suddenly all of a sudden it's an emergency.
So, Phil, to clarify a couple things. One, the law, as previously understood, where he had to go through all these regulations that you were saying he doesn't like psychologically or administratively or however we want to think about it, would normally, say, dumping wouldn't apply to a whole country.
It would just apply to a specific industry.
Right.
Or a single product. So that's why he doesn't like these other sections of the trade law, because they're all restricted. So you can only target one industry, or in some very serious cases, maybe there are emergency economic sanctions you can put on a specific country for diplomatic and military reasons. But you can't do that to the entire world. And that's what he doesn't like. So he's invented this new power under the IEEPA statute that doesn't even appear in the statute, and said, well, this gives me the authority to declare an emergency and also go about unilaterally rewriting the tariff schedule of the United States with every country on earth just by executive decree that I'm going to tweet out on Truth Social, basically. So everything we've seen for the past 5 or 6 months has been Trump claiming an executive power that does not exist in U.S. statute. He also likes it because he can change it on a whim. If he decides on Tuesday that the tariff rate on the EU should be 15% and then changes his mind and says, well, I'm going to go 20% on Thursday, he thinks he can just change it by a stroke of a pen.
So again, to clarify, this emergency law was previously understood and looks like from the plain language of the law to apply to things like economic sanctions as
Absolutely.
A tool of diplomacy or quasi-war even.
Absolutely.
And
it
not to tariffs as the part of the international trading system or the American piece of the international trading system.
Right. Its traditional use has been an adversary power is enriching uranium, so therefore we put sanctions on them. Or Russia is taking hostile actions that we dislike related to another country, and rather than getting involved directly in the conflict, we put international economic pressure on them. These are the types of traditional uses of IEEPA. Trump has completely redefined its purpose and thrown that out the window and said, no, this is basically a license for me to regulate the entire world economy by decree. And he's the first president that's ever interpreted the statute this way. 8 to 10 months ago, this would have been considered a crackpot legal theory. It's just out of the world of conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. I mean, that there were no serious legal scholars. I mean, a few on the fringes, but those always exist. But no real serious legal scholars thought that this was a viable pathway to impose tariffs. But what has Trump done? He's found attorneys that are willing to make that argument for him and just proceeded full speed ahead. Well, he had a problem with that because obviously, you invent a novel legal theory. You use it to enact a sweeping economic agenda that upends the entire global trading economy. Somebody's going to get noticed, and people are going to be harmed by that. People are going to pay taxes.
So it seems to me there's a couple of other aspects to this. Now, there's also an international trade court.
Absolutely.
That's already ruled on this. And that's, I'm talking about an American court, I think.
Oh, this is the U.S. International Trade Court. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And it's the legal endeavors in that are separate from the
regular ongoings of the federal.
Yes. There's sort of at least two legal controversies that are going forward.
Yeah, exactly. And this is an important point that listeners should understand this, because Trump rants and raves about judicial overreach on the district court level, and in some of those cases he has valid arguments. I mean, judges have been putting in nationwide injunctions over cases that are very localized, and some of those are valid injunctions, others are not. We can debate the merits of them, but that's not what is happening here. There is a separate federal court system set up under United States law that handles and deals with cases only in international trade. And traditionally, this is where, you know, if you're an importer and the Customs Bureau overcharges you the goods that are you're bringing in and dropping off at port, and you have a claim against them, you go to the International Trade Court and you can file a lawsuit and say, no, I should have been charged at this. This is the incorrect rate. I should have gotten a different rate.
So the U.S. Court for International Trade issued a ruling in May.
Exactly. And
that was in the case brought by some organization, or I guess it's a U.S. importer called VOS Selections Incorporated. Yep. So they filed suit. Also, state of Oregon, plus 12 other states, got in on the same action. And the Court of International Trade seems to have ruled that this, well, you call it IEEPA, which is a pretty funny name, Emergency Economic Powers Act, IEEPA. Okay. Now I can sound like a policy wonk if I say IEEPA. But that court said in May that IEEPA does not give the president that broad authority. And if it did, it would be unconstitutional. Have I got that right?
That's exactly it. So it's a very straightforward conservative ruling that came out of the Court of International Trade. And here's an important part of that court. It was a three-judge panel. It was a unanimous ruling. One of the judges was a Democrat appointee. Two of the judges were Republican appointees, including a Trump appointee from his last term. So this is not a stacked court. This is not a left-wing court operating outside its bounds. It is a statutory empowered court with nationwide jurisdiction exclusively on international trade cases. And they brought a very standard, straightforward suit that said the tariffs assessed against VOS selections were illegal and unconstitutional. And the court reviewed that evidence, and through very straightforward legal reasoning, so they examined the statute and they find, well, the word tariff doesn't appear in there, so it can't be sanctioned in that way. They also reviewed the constitutional issues, and there are two major ones at play here that are really kind of the core of conservative originalist jurisprudence. Everything that the right has been celebrating, I think, for good reason for many years.
Forgive me for trying to dig into this a little further, but I think it would occur to a conservative originalist or a constitutionalist that, one, the Constitution says that Congress shall be the one that lays taxes.
That's exactly it.
And then there's the everyday meaning of emergency. And here's trade deficits that all his April 2nd reciprocal tariffs, whatever that really means here, but they were linked to trade deficits that have been going on for decades. So how does that constitute an emergency is something that these judges have to be tackling.
Well, and the court points this out in very clear terms, both of these issues. Says the first one, the constitutional issue, it's Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution lists all the powers that Congress has. And the very first enumerated power is the power to collect imposts, duties, and excises to raise revenue for the government. It says this is exclusively Congress's power. Not only that, bills for this must originate in the U.S. House of Representatives. The tax power belongs to the legislature.
So Congress cannot give away that power. We'd have to say the legislature has been somewhat lazy or dodging this.
They have not
really living up to non-delegation doctrines.
So they haven't asserted themselves, but at the same time, I don't think anyone in 1977 thought they were delegating the power of the of tax collection to the president when they passed IEEPA. So this novel interpretation that Trump came up with decades later is just a reinventing of the plain letter of the statute. But the doctrine here is very clear, and it actually ties back to these other types of tariffs that we've traditionally used, the anti-dumping and national security tariffs. Because non-delegation, this notion that Congress can't give up its power to the executive branch, is rooted back to the origins of U.S. constitutional law. It's some of the very first cases that come before the Supreme Court are about this. Like, how much can the executive branch exercise under its own discretion based on the powers that Congress gives us? And over the years, the Supreme Court has come up with a rough test that they apply. And the test is called the Intelligible Principle Doctrine. It says that Congress must specify in the statute an intelligible principle by which the executive branch can act on these powers that are bestowed upon it. And the interesting thing here is this intelligible principle test, it comes from a 1927 court case, J.W. Hampton versus the United States, which was the first Supreme Court test of one of these earlier delegated tariff powers. Congress set up parameters and said to the Coolidge administration, here's the tariff schedule, we've set it, but under these circumstances, you can vary certain rates for a limited amount of time and with congressional oversight, and it has to undergo regulatory review of a tariff commission. And the Supreme Court said, well, this isn't an unconstitutional delegation because that principle has been laid out in the statute. Congress, therefore, still technically maintains control.
So that's important because in that case and in the statute that Congress passed back then, they put tight boundaries around delegation.
Exactly.
And delegation is a bad thing, just to be really clear, because if Congress delegates its power, it messes up the separation of powers of the U.S. Constitution.
Well, and we've seen this in recent years. So the last Supreme Court term, they had a major case about the Environmental Protection Agency that was exceeding its delegation and was intruding into what they call major questions. Major questions being questions of political or economic significance that have to be decided by Congress. The EPA was basically saying, we're going to take this vague statute and interpret it in such a way that gives ourselves sweeping power. And the Supreme Court struck that down. Other recent instances, Joe Biden, remember, he asserted that he had the power to cancel student loans. And the Supreme Court reviewed that. And they said, wait a minute, you're stretching the statute beyond any and all recognition. This is unconstitutional. So in a weird way, Trump is using the Joe Biden strategy from student loans to reinterpret the IEPA statute to give him all these sweeping emergency powers to enact tariffs.
Now, a lot of ordinary people might, if you asked them, well, does the president have power to regulate commerce, you know, with the rest of the world? They'd say, well, yeah, right, he does. But then I'm looking at Article 1, Section 8 in front of me, which is the very section you were just quoting from, which gives Congress the power over tariffs. The next little bit says Congress has the power
to regulate commerce
of foreign nations.
Yes. Yeah.
Not the president, but Congress, which sounds like a difficult job for Congress to do because they have to get voting all the time and stuff. But nevertheless, it says Congress is the one who regulates commerce with foreign nations.
And historically, up until very, very recently, up until basically the Biden administration, Congress played that role in trade agreements. So historical trade agreements passed basically since the end of World War II to up until very, very recently have generally had to go through a process where the president, either through the State Department, and then he later got the U.S. Trade Representative, which is his special ambassador to negotiate trade deals. They go to the foreign countries and they negotiate the deal, but they bring it back to Congress. And Congress, based on the procedures that were in place at the time, would hold the vote to either affirm or deny the deal. That was the congressional regulatory oversight of international commerce as stated in the Constitution. So Trump has completely thrown that out the window as well. He's basically said, I don't need Congress to make trade deals. I'm going to get on the phone with my counterpart in the EU or my counterpart in Japan and claim that I have a deal. But notice none of these deals he's supposedly negotiated have been released on paper.
Right.
And oftentimes the terms of them are renegotiated a couple days later and announced on Truth Social. These are not conventional trade deals. So he's also bypassing that regulatory part. And you know, make a long story short, the U.S. International Trade Court reviewed all this and they said, we're not buying this. We have none of this. And it was kind of an earthquake of a ruling. The Trump administration wasn't really expecting it. They said, you know, what you're doing is illegal and it would be unconstitutional if this power that you claimed from IEPA existed. So the court basically said, stop. This was back in May, but then the usual appellate process kicks into gear.
Well, if that ruling had been final and enforced, then that would have like pulled the plug on the entire tariff. But instead, they gave it a stay pending appeal.
Yeah, and this is a fairly routine thing, and you have high-profile constitutional cases. They get a stay as the appellate process plays out, because everyone knew this is eventually going to the Supreme Court.
But why didn't it go straight to the Supreme Court?
Well, because at the time, they interpreted the case as following the usual judicial pattern. The judiciary operates on its own schedule. It's slow and plodding. It's not always as fast as we want it to be. But, you know, this is true of almost every case it hears. It's really the exception that the Supreme Court steps in and does an extreme emergency move. So this is just following the normal pattern. But the appellate court does take it up, and they did something that was a little unconventional. They ordered it to be heard on an expedited schedule. So rather than years and years of filing briefs and all this legal jockeying, they said, basically, you have about a month to get your case in. You get your briefs filed, and we're going to go immediately to oral arguments, and we're going to hold the oral arguments in bank in front of the entire appellate court. And that's what happened a couple weeks ago.
On July 31.
Exactly. Exactly.
Bill?
I've forgotten what I was going to ask. But it seems to me you were talking about Trump getting on the phone and making these deals or announcing these deals on Truth Social. And one of the interesting aspects, there's sort of two interesting aspects to this that I thought Phil might want to further talk about. So one is a certain conservative commentators, I think Stephen Moore would be a case, were hoping that we would end up, and he was following on from some comments that Trump had made, that we would get so-called zero-for-zero trade agreements.
Sure, sure.
In other words, the U.S. would reduce its tariff taxes payments to zero and reduce its non-tariff barriers to zero, and in return, the other country would do the same. And then, as we looked at these, though, it's instead this 10% basis and then average of 15%. So tariffs are moving from around 2%
to much
to
higher.
Being much higher at 15%.
Yeah. This reflects there's an internal battle and internal inconsistency in the Trump administration. And this has been playing out basically since day one. There are a lot of people that like tariffs, but all for different reasons. One of the factions of that wanted it for this diplomatic leverage to try to get other countries to lower their barriers. Although if you look at the industrialized world, most of our major industrialized trading partners already had lower tariffs against the United States than we imposed on them before Trump took office. This is true of every index. Look at the Heritage Index of Economic Freedom, the Economic Freedom of the World from Fraser. They have subcomponents that look at free trade, and the U.S. is way down the list behind the EU, behind Canada, Britain, Australia. So we have been the bad actor there. But nonetheless, there are some residual very low tariffs that other countries applied against us. And the thought was maybe we can leverage them into reducing those even further. But you have this other faction in the administration that just simply wants tariffs across the board to be higher. They want a minimum baseline tariff that started at 10%. Now they've ratcheted up to 15% as of August 1st. And some want it even higher. And the reasons for this are a multitude. Some factions in the Trump administration want it for protection reasons, because they just like high tariffs to discriminate against imports and supposedly advantage American industries. Others have discovered, hey, this is a source of new tax revenue to spend, to fund the one big beautiful bill. And they think if they keep tariffs high on the U.S. side, that new stream of revenue, billions of dollars, as Trump always says, will be able to fund all their spending projects.
So Phil,
there's the inconsistency we have internally.
So, Phil, one thing that the Trump administration and its defenders, proponents, whatever, have pointed to is that we haven't seen retail prices generally moving up 15%. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how to explain or understand this, and whether we're looking at a short-term situation versus a longer-term one.
Well, the very first thing to realize when the Trump administration is claiming it, they are flat-out lying. It's engaged in economic deception. of the same magnitude when Joe Biden said inflation was not a problem, when it was only transitory. The economic evidence, and you know, unfortunately, this has come from some top officials. J.D. Vance says it. Howard Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, tweets and goes on TV and makes this claim all the time that prices are not rising. I can show you direct data from the Harvard Pricing Lab that has been tracking retail prices across major online consumers. They have this great little tool, and what it does is it scrapes websites of national retailers every day to see if prices have changed on the same product. So it's a real-time measure to see how prices are responding to tariffs. And their latest release, you see this pattern. Prices were on a stable, steady, kind of slow, gradual decline from the peak of inflation in 2023. I think they start measuring in early 2024. But you see the slow, stable decline playing out not only through the Biden years, but the first couple of weeks or even months of the Trump administration. Then you hit Tariff Liberation Day, and it's a hockey stick. Not only on imported goods, though, because you think, you know, a tariff targets imported goods. That's where the tax is assessed. Domestic produced retail goods started going up as well.
Right.
At the exact same moment.
Because that's the market. And
that's
therefore,
the market.
The domestic producers are going to go to the market price. They're not going to hold theirs below the tariff goods. They're going to rise to the level of the
tariff goods. They're
going to
take advantage of this reality. And it is clear as day. It is right there on Tariff Liberation Day in April is when the hockey stick starts. And ever since then, retail prices have been hovering at a much higher level. Now, they haven't jumped up immediately by 10 or 15%, which was the level of the tariff. But there's a reason. There's several reasons for that. And this is what I think your question was alluding to. So one, yes, you do have the administration. They are engaged in deception. They are misleading the public about real economic data. But that's only part of the story. The other part of the story is that there are ripple effects that take many months or some, in some cases, even years to play out when you enact a policy like this. Because of the uncertainty of the current tariff regime, you know, imagine you're a major retailer who draws all your imports from other parts of the world, and you don't know if this new 15% tariff is going to be permanent. You don't know if it's going to be struck down in court next week by the appellate court or the Supreme Court. You don't know if Trump's going to change his mind and renegotiate the deal. What do you do? Well, you try to bide your time and absorb some of the cost at the moment so you aren't too disruptive of the market. So this has created something of a stickiness on retail prices. Even though they've started to creep upward, as you see on that hockey stick, at the same time, retailers have done what they can to resist even larger increases in prices. And then the third factor after this is Trump only put in a 10% baseline after Liberation Day. Remember, he threatened much higher rates, but then the stock market collapsed. The bond market went into a seller's crisis. There were all sorts of issues that emerged in that week afterward. And then facing basically an economic crisis, Trump walked it all back and put in this 90-day pause. Well, that pause remained in effect until August 1st. And then August 1st, he started ratcheting everything up back up again. Well, we only have price data through the end of July. So when you get that next update at the end of August, you're going to start seeing more and more effects of these brand new second waves of tariffs that Trump imposed after August 1st that are just now starting to take hold. So you are absolutely seeing the price effects. It's just ratcheting up step after step after step.
Now some commentators, and I'm thinking of John Lott, who is he's trained in social sciences. He's a brilliant researcher on gun control and firearms and crime matters. But he posed the possibility, in his view, that instead of looking at this in terms of protection and various things, we should view this as part of an optimal tax structure, tax system, and that, you know, there's other places where taxes might be viewed as too high. There could be adjustments up and down. And I wondered what your thinking was about. I know you wrote about what you thought about Lott's argument.
I had a little bit of
a
back and forth with Lott directly on this. So there are a couple issues. First off, I think he is engaged in some very, very wishful thinking here. In an ideal world, if I were the economic guru and I could rewrite the entire tax system of the United States, yes, there are areas where I would reduce taxes and possibly offset them by other types of taxes to balance the budget. That's not the political reality we live in. The political reality we live in is that taxes only tend to go in one direction, and that is up. Spending only tends to go in one direction, and that is up. Even the supposed tax cuts that we got in the One Big Beautiful Bill weren't really cuts. We just made existing rates permanent. Existing rates that were about to expire were made permanent. So it's forestalling an even further tax hike that was on the horizon.
Which was a good thing, but it wasn't a tax reduction.
It's a good thing, but it is not a tax cut, and it's not accurate to portray it as a tax cut. And yet spending was increased at even larger amounts in that same bill. And here's the trick. Yes, there are people in the Trump administration who view tariffs not only as a protective mean, they view it as a new revenue source. And here's the internal contradiction. You know, Trump's appointees and subordinates, they fall into this trap. I like to call it Schrodinger's tariff. It's both a tax and not a tax at the same time. And it seems to pivot back and forth between that based on whenever it's convenient to be.
Very good coinage, Schrodinger's.
Schrodinger's tariff. It's
refers
kind of
to Schrodinger's cat in physics and so forth.
Yeah.
So wouldn't you say there's also another version of John Lott's argument that comes from the left and from the what you might call worker-oriented or labor-oriented right? And this is the idea that really tariffs are going to have an egalitarian redistributive effect. So I wonder if you address this.
I mean, that's downright delusional. That's like at odds with all the economic literature. The reason being, tariffs, where do they hit most? It's small retail items, especially these types of tariffs that Trump's enacting. These are not targeted tariffs on luxury yachts. Right. These are tariffs on
staples. They're sort of staples
goods.
of regular people,
or raw materials that go
producer
into
producer goods, right?
What we call consumer durables. So, like your washing machine and your television. These things use steel and aluminum and computer chips and basic items that are components of production that everyday people use. Well, where's the hit going to be hardest from that? It's going to be at the lower end of the income stratus. A wealthy person can absorb the fact that their new Mercedes costs $5,000 more because of steel tariffs. A poor person who's buying a baseline Kia that now has a tariff assessed against it is finding what could be, you know, multiple thousands of dollars out of their income are now diverted into just a basic production or their goods at the store at Walmart.
And as you were saying earlier, it's not just the Kia from abroad that's going to be affected. All the bottom tier of automobiles are also going to go up at the same time.
Yeah. So Kia and Toyota, they get a tariff on them directly. Ford and Chevy are going to do the same thing, not only to match the prices, but their raw materials, their aluminum and steel that goes into their engine also has a tariff on it.
Right.
So what are they doing? They have to raise costs to pass that on.
So tariffs are not going to be egalitarian in effect, rather the opposite.
You know, they are an extreme example of regressive taxation.
Right. So let's skip back to the legal point, because as we have explained, as you have explained, the entire edifice of Trump's tariff system is really sitting on the edge of a precipice.
Exactly.
Because it's built upon these claims of presidential power, which seem to be, according to the courts so far, completely unsubstantiatable. So in May, the Court of International Trade said no way. And then it was taken up by the Court of Appeals for the Federal District. They They had hearings on July 31st. They're about to rule. Right. It seems very likely that they're going to agree with the Court of International Trade, which means that they then, if I got this right, they'll probably stay the enforcement of their order pending appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Then the Supreme Court is going to have to take all these issues up. And so it looks like that the peril is growing greater and greater and greater for this entire edifice to come crashing down.
So, and so that is exactly it.
So, Phil, I think you should then tell our listeners something about the Justice Department's doomsday letter.
Oh, yes, yes. So the nature of the stay, and this is an important part of the story because, you know, back in May, when the lower court, the International Trade Court, rules, they go through a very standard procedural stay. They say this is going through the appellate process, and the appellate court granted the stay. But when the government requested that, they filed the legal brief to argue why a stay was needed. And usually when they do this, there's a contestation that goes back and forth between the parties because the plaintiffs, of course, they don't want the stay. They need immediate relief. And the plaintiffs argue, well, if you continue to collect these tariffs, it continues to assess damages against us that will accrue in the future. That's the standard argument.
Right.
The government
the burden is ongoing and gets higher and accumulates.
Yeah. And the government says, no. You don't have to worry about damages in the future because if this eventual tariff measure by the president is overturned by the higher court, if the lower court's ruling is upheld and these are stricken down as unconstitutional, all we have to do is get the U.S. Treasury Department to refund the taxes that were collected. And they say,
which is a
because
lot.
Because of that, there's no emergency. There's no irreparable damage. We can allow this to continue to play out. And if we lose later down the line, we'll make it right because all the Treasury Department has to do is order Customs to refund the money that was collected. And the appellate court said, okay, that's a reasonable argument because there is a path to remediation of the damage.
But
that's quarter, 3 months later.
Right. They've totally overthrown their previous argument.
Yes, exactly. The appellate court hears the case, and based on the oral arguments, it did not go well for the government. The Justice Department lawyer shows up unprepared. He's caught off guard by the very first question. He starts to open up his argument, and one of the first justices intervenes and says, I just read that statute. I don't see where the word tariff appears. So they know it's going bad for them. Again, it's hard to count your chickens before they hatch, but the widespread consensus was that this hearing did not go well for the government, and that usually signals that the appellate court is probably going to do something that rules at least partially, if not fully, against the Trump administration. So after the arguments go bad for the Trump administration, the DOJ comes back with a new letter. And this is the doomsday letter that was one of the most bizarre legal arguments I have ever read. And that's just my opinion as a historian, outside commentator. I know attorneys that read this. They thought the thing was a spoof, a hoax, because it was so absurd. I have friends that work in foreign governments, foreign trade policy, and their counterparts to what the U.S. does on international trade. And they were texting me from abroad. They read this letter and they said, is this thing for real? Our government's trying to decide whether or not this should be a valid part of our negotiations. Well, what does the letter do? It makes this over-the-top doomsday argument that says, tariffs are such an essential part of President Trump's economic agenda that we are now on the line for trillions upon trillions of dollars in tariff revenue that we've already pledged.
And a 1929 depression effect.
And a 1929 depression. And they're basically telling the court that even if you rule against us on the merits, if you
make a tax cut, it will destroy the economy vibrancy, which is the opposite of
the exact opposite
all
of what
supply
they were
saying. Side like, effects.
Yeah, you know, a way to summarize it would be to say the government told the court, sorry, we actually can't repay the tariffs after all, because we've already spent the money that we've collected. And not only that,
that might be true.
Yeah, well, it might be true. But they not only spent the money they've already collected, we've already spent the next 10 years of money we project to collect.
And so you can't rule against us on the merits because, the consequences would be too terrible.
Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly.
So I saw that Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent recently was on Fox News, apparently, or was it Fox Business? I don't remember. But he said, I think this is verbatim. I think the more deals we've done, the more coming in, it gets harder and harder for SCOTUS to rule against us. So that wasn't an argument about the Constitution or statute. It was an argument about we're too far into this big mistake, so the Supreme Court won't dare rule on the basis of law.
Well, and this is horrifying to me from someone who just cares about the Constitution.
It's a kind of sunk cost type argument.
Exactly. If it's saying tariffs are too big to fail.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That is exactly mm-hmm. right.
So Phil,
there's been another interesting development in all this, and that is the effect on various economists and administrators. So we've seen people being proposed to the Federal Reserve because of their views on the dollar and whether tariffs interact with the value of the dollar or the need to devalue the dollar. There's also been this firing of the Bureau of Labor Statistics person when job results possibly connected to the tariff.
Possibly connected to tariffs. Yeah, we got a bad jobs report.
Right.
That seemed to show a slowdown, of which tariffs are probably an instigating part. And what did Trump do? He responded by firing the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
And don't forget to get into this devaluation of the dollar thing.
Yes.
And also Goldman Sachs' economist being put down by President Trump.
Yeah, so on top of all these legal issues, we're standing on the edge of a knife waiting for a court ruling that could, on very valid constitutional grounds, strike down the entire Trump tariff agenda. That's how sweeping this is. If they uphold the lower court, every deal, every letter, every tweet in Truth Social that Trump has sent out announcing a new rate, void it. Unconstitutional overnight.
They could try to get them through Congress. It would be
they could, but he faces an uphill battle because I don't think he has the votes right now to do that. Right. And that's exactly why he used the emergency orders, because if he put this before Congress in a bill, there would be enough Republicans that are free traders sitting on the fence that would join with the Democrats who are just opposed to Trump that they could not win a majority.
Right.
He knows that, so that's why he's using the executive order route. But here,
of course, the Democrats could decide to get worker-itis themselves.
That's always the risk.
Come out for
it depends on does their Trump derangement of the moment exceed their traditional Bernie Sanders-esque politics?
Yeah.
And but at least so far, weirdly, Trump's tariff agenda has made free traders out of Elizabeth Warren.
She's going back to her libertarian roots, back when she was cavorting with Henry Manning.
It's quite a strange thing. So you have all this court stuff is coming down. We're teetering on the edge of extreme uncertainty that could invalidate the entire tariff agenda. But what is Trump doing? He's turning on the gas and accelerating with the agenda for the reasons that Scott Bessent hinted at in that interview. And then there's for another reason, because he's intertwined it with monetary policy. And this is where alarm bells start going off for me as a trade economist. I was never of the opinion that trade alone could sink us into a recession. It could be a contributing factor. Tariffs could be something that, along with other factors, slows down the U.S. economy and puts us into a state of economic turmoil or stagnation. But alone, we're too big of an economy unless it's like completely shutting us off to the rest of the world to have that sort of an effect. But there is another dimension to it. There's a component, one of the many tariff factions in the Trump administration, and this has come out of Stephen Miron, who's the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, and was one of the architects of the Liberation Day fiasco back in April. There's a lot of indirect evidence suggesting that he was the source or one of the sources of, you may remember the reciprocal terra formula that turned out to be like completely made up nonsense with Greek letters dressing up a voided denominator. But he was the academic sophistication version of the base protectionism that others in the Trump administration. So he's a protectionist, but he does so from an economic background, although he's really on the fringes of the academic discipline. So Myron came really out of nowhere. I mean, he was he had been a minor Treasury official before this, and then some stuff in the private sector. But a very unusual pick for the Council of Economic Advisors chair, because usually the people that go into this, they have extensive academic backgrounds. They're usually top economists. They're Greg Mankiw at Harvard in the Bush administration, or Jason Furman in the Obama administration. These are well-known, widely cited economists that have substantial academic careers. When Trump tapped Myron...
Boskin, for example.
Yeah, exactly. So Trump tapped Myron. Most people saw this name and were like, who is this guy? And if you look at his academic background, he has almost no publications. His only specialty was in state budget policy. But prior to getting the job, he wrote essentially what is seen as like an audition paper for the Council of Economic Advisors. And it was this lengthy memorandum, and it's referred to as the Mar-a-Lago Accord paper. And in it, he develops what I would call an extremely heterodox reinvention of the entirety of trade economics. And his argument is that trade imbalances, the differences between imported and exported goods and services, so not the full exchanges that are occurring across borders, but just the trade in goods and services, products, which is it's an accounting error to focus on this, especially what I'm getting at. But he says the fact that we've had a trade imbalance for basically about 50 years is not the result so much of a particular trade policies in and of itself. It's actually a reflection of the dollar's position as the international currency unit, as the dominant currency unit. And he goes back into some really kind of weird 1950s and 60s Keynesian theory that was built around the old Bretton Woods system that is no longer even in place. This was discarded in the Nixon administration. But he says, he basically says...
And this is Robert Triffin, especially.
Yes, exactly. This is the Triffin dilemma. But he says basically because the United States is in this unique position of having the dominant international currency, the dollar, it has, different circumstances than a usual trade imbalance would bring. And he thinks, he's convinced himself, and I'll be perfectly honest, I've read through this paper, this guy does not understand international trade theory at an undergraduate level. I'm not the only person to say that. The Wall Street Journal has reviewed it in length and has pointed out these errors. There are authors he cites in this paper that have discovered the way that he's using their work, and they've come out and said, wait a minute, that's not what we were saying. You misread our model. But the gist of it comes down to is he thinks that he can leverage a devaluation of the U.S. dollar on the international market through managed levers and tools and negotiations, and that this in turn will correct and offset and rebalance trade. That's essentially his argument. Now, this is a problem because tariffs, all else equal, tariffs on a foreign country tend to strengthen the domestic currency, holding everything else equal. And Myron, he at least knows this. He says he's got a paradox. The tariffs that I want for protective and revenue reasons are at odds with my dollar devaluation program. So what he proposes, and this is the Mar-a-Lago Accord scheme, is he says we are going to use negotiations and levers to basically coerce other countries into accepting what is for them unfavorable exchange rates against the dollar. Or if other countries are holders of U.S. Treasury securities and holders of debt, you know, at any given time, you know, in the neighborhood of 15 to 30% of the U.S. national debt in recent decades has been held by foreign powers, held abroad. These are all in international trade in securities and that entire market. But we think about this, it's not so much a curse. It's the fact that they other countries are voting with their own money and their own resources to invest in the United States because it's seen as a stable economy, a stable currency. So other countries, what do? They buy treasury bills. Myron says we can use leverage such as tariffs and threats of tariffs and other penalties in the international arena to force countries that hold treasury bills to exchange them for longer term century bonds at unfavorable exchange rates, basically. And he says we should also consider placing a tax on foreign holdings of U.S. treasuries.
Ooh, wow.
To penalize it. Now, what do these instruments do? The short end of it, this is a backdoor default on the U.S. national debt.
Mm-hmm.
It's taking stronger assets and forcibly converting them into weaker assets or lower yield assets.
Coercing others to take the worse asset.
And so this man has been the head of the White House Council on Economic Advisors.
We're going to
Trump
give you a deal that you can't refuse. It's like either take the deal and exchange your short-term treasury bills for century bonds, or else the tariff against you is not going to be 15%. Now you get a 30% tariff.
So he's been the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, but now Trump is saying, I want to elevate you to a slot on the Federal Reserve Board.
So a board seat opened on the Federal Reserve Board. And again, remember that this is a guy, his background is in, his only academic expertise from his PhD was in state budgeting, fiscal economics at the state level. That's his only published paper. But he auditioned for the job as a protectionist and got it. So Trump loves that. And then he's become kind of one of the major architects of this entire unconstitutional mess of a tariff policy that we've had for the last 6 months.
Which is about to go down in flames with the courts.
Which is about to go down in flames with the court. And then a seat opens up on the Federal Reserve Board because one of the Biden appointees retired early. So what does Trump do? Trump has for a whole variety of other reasons, been trying to pressure the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates, which I think there's some valid argument that rates should maybe go down a bit. I've actually argued in favor of that. I don't know if the level that Trump wants, and I think there are better arguments coming from other economists, but Trump wants interest rates lower. So he saw this opportunity, and now he has nominated his chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, Stephen Myron, this dollar devaluationist, radical trade protectionist, heterodox thinker that's far outside of the mainstream of economics on trade policy, that is also expressed an interest in pursuing a monetary policy that can only be described as MMT styles of inflationism. And he's nominated that to be his guy on the Federal Reserve Board.
Phil, somebody could respond to your point here by saying, well, he's not part of the swamp. And so it doesn't matter if he's mistaken, because he's not part of the swamp, at least. And we don't want those swamp people running everything. But does that mean, but if people who make that argument are basically saying, well, as long as we don't get insiders running stuff, we don't care if it trashes the U.S. economy.
Yeah,
because he's not a swamp monster.
I think this goes so far beyond that consideration. I'd say it's more akin to NASA hiring a chief rocket scientist, not out of the astronomy department, but out of the astrology convention.
Ouch.
This guy is so far outside of the economic mainstream. And you know, I'm not going to fault someone for not being a trade economist. It's a very specialized discipline. Even most economists are not fully versed in the trade economics literature. This is a subfield. But if you're going to wade into trade policy, you should know what you're doing. If you're going to launch rockets into space, you should know how to do the calculations.
So we're facing, to kind of come down for a landing here soon, which we need to do.
Continue the metaphor.
Well, yeah. So we're facing two kinds of threats here. One is the fact that the Trump administration is basically saying that they're wanting to coerce the courts into a favorable outcome because, look how bad the results will be. And yet the courts may well decide against the entire Trump tariff regime. And we're also facing a threat from another element of economic policy represented by Stephen Miron, which could be a drastic effect on U.S. monetary policy.
Tied to his very fringe theories about how international trade
works. Right. So when is the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal District likely to issue its ruling?
Right. So it had its hearing on the 31st, and then the follow-up motions have been filed. They operate on their own schedule. Historically, it's roughly about a month after the hearing that these decisions tend to come down. So it could be any day now.
Okay. And then they'll probably stay it pending appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, correct or not?
That would be the conventional assumption, although there's some theory that Trump may have overplayed his hand by this this crazy letter that they sent, the doomsday letter, and the fact that they contradicted their previous rationale for a stay. It's basically admitting to the courts that, hey, we lied to you. Justices don't like being lied to.
Right. So they may have lost their chance to get a stay.
It could have been a self-inflicted wound. I mean, we'll see how that plays out. But I think it's increased the chance that the court might deny a motion like that.
Right. That's interesting. But if they do rule against Trump's tariffs, which is likely, and even if they don't give a stay, the Trump administration will appeal it to the Supreme Court in that case.
That is exactly it. So it's guaranteed to be appealed.
Hoping for a better outcome, and the Treasury Secretary has already threatened the court by telling them, we're getting so much. You're going to mess so much stuff up, you can't rule against us. What if the Supreme Court tried to find, I'm thinking of John Roberts here, what if the U.S. Supreme Court tried to find a way to navigate this thing? So, for example, this just occurred to me. Tell me if this is crazy or whether this is John Roberts type of thing. What if the court ruled, AIPA doesn't grant him these powers, but it was a misinterpretation of AIPA done in good faith. And therefore, although it has to stop now, they don't have to reimburse all the billions of dollars collected. Could that happen?
There is actually an interesting legal route here. So the Supreme Court would basically have any time between now and the end of their term, which is next June, to hear the case. And again, they're the Supreme Court. They get to decide their own schedule. They could rule on it instantly. They could wait to the very last day. But the arguments that go before the Supreme Court are going to be interesting for a couple of reasons. First off, many of the conservative originalist justices have made their judicial mark in the last 4 or 5 years by striking down the Biden student loan effort, by striking down the EPA's attempts to claim major questions under its purview. Several justices have hinted that non-delegation is a major constitutional principle that needs to be rearticulated and reasserted. In other words, several of the justices, and particularly those on the right, and I'm talking like Gorsuch, Alito, Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, even Clarence Thomas, to some respect, these are the originalist faction of the Supreme Court. In order to rule in favor of Trump on AIPA, they would have to throw out quite a bit of their own judicial track record and core judicial philosophy. They would have to say, we're making an exception where originalism doesn't pertain here.
They're not going to do that.
And I have at least enough hope and confidence, a glimmer of confidence in here that these are serious legal thinkers that are not going to turn to throw out their principles. Now, the liberal faction of the court tends to be much more oriented toward, what I would call outcomes-based jurisprudence.
Which is what Scott Bessent is arguing, outcomes-based.
It is, But Scott Bissent is arguing that from a Trump administration perspective, if you're an outcomes-based jurisprudence person on the left, the outcome you want is the exact opposite of what Scott Bissent is saying.
And you might be a Paul Krugman type person or
very much so. Right. Very much so. So I could see a scenario where the three left-leaning justices actually end up siding with the originalists on the basis that their outcome, which is hostile to the Trump administration's assertion of executive power, also happens to align with the correct originalist interpretation.
So they might have concurring opinions, and it could be 9-0.
It could be interesting.
Or it could be the left part of the court sides with Trump, the right part of the court sides against Trump, and Roberts is sitting there in the middle, not sure who he's going.
Yeah, which faction. He could be the median vote even. And you know, go back to the scenario that Graham tested. I actually think that there is one very odd, narrow scenario that could play out. It's not my ideal, but it would be better than the status quo of tariffs continuing. And that is, there's an obscure clause in the Trade Act of 1974 that it's one of these, another one of these exceptions where it allows the president to enact tariffs in special cases. And it's a balance of payments exception. And this was enacted in the wake of abandoning the Bretton Woods system to allow the president to take measures to ensure that we didn't have a payments crisis coming out of the Treasury, although there are ways that you could do a very loose interpretation of that statute that the balance of payments also translates over into balance of trade. And what this statute does is it gave the president a 150-day window to declare a balance of payments emergency and go through the regulatory process and present the evidence before Congress. He says, for up to a maximum of 150 days, you can put a tariff of up to 15% in place against countries in which we're in the negative in terms of balance of payments. This is not what Trump pursued, obviously. It's not the statute he invoked, but I could see a scenario where judges, justices try to carve out this is their backdoor option. They say, well, and what it would mean, so now do the calculation, 150 days from Liberation Day back in April is what? The end of August, right now.
Wow.
So it's conceivable they could, you know, if they were to take this route, they could declare.
So well, this Trump would be like Roberts on Obamacare.
Exactly.
It's exactly.
Exactly. He didn't exactly follow the Constitution or the procedure, but we're going to reinterpret this other law that it does permit limited tariffs in this case. And it permits them for 150 days. They've run their course. Therefore, going forward, no more tariffs.
Right.
But for the past 150 days, we're going to let that slide.
Yes. How strange maybe, that would be.
Maybe only up to 15%, though.
Maybe. Yeah, only up to 15%.
Or maybe they could go with spirit of the law rather than letter of the law.
So the 15% is a pretty hard cap, and they could get the 10% Liberation Day, the one that he ratcheted back down to, under that.
Yes.
Anything in excess to it. But it would be like a face-saving measure. But again, right. You know, this is purely speculative. It's not my ideal scenario.
Right, nor mine.
But it would be better than allowing it to continue. And I think the point that needs to be emphasized here is every day that this goes on, the damage gets worse. The damage to our constitutional order gets worse. We are already operating outside of the boundaries of the Constitution. We're violating the separation of powers. The president has asserted a power that he simply does not have in a constitutional system of government. And if we sanction that for Trump on tariffs, you know, the question I ask, what happens if 4 or 8 years ago we have, by some fluke, a President Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez who decides that climate change is an international emergency.
Exactly.
And bans the trade in fossil fuels to stem the climate emergency, citing the IEPA power that had been sustained under the Trump administration's use of tariffs. This is not an implausible scenario.
No, it's very consistent logically.
Exactly. It's if anything's an emergency, we can declare it as such because the president has discretion to do so. and he or she can enact through executive and order economic controls on anything and everything outside of the congressional process to deal with that emergency. It's back like lockdowns again. COVID, such an emergency, we must suspend the Constitution, was the default statement. Mm-hmm. Climate change is such an emergency, we must suspend international commerce. That's game over. That's the death knell of the constitutional system.
It really is. And if balance of payments deficits is a comparable crisis, then they're all... than anything is, right, exactly. So,
let's say the use of firearms and crime
Is
so widespread that we need to halt all international trade in firearms.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Second Amendment is too dangerous. Yeah. So
then you see they start expanding the list. They'll say, well, firearms, but also components of firearms. And firearms are made of steel and aluminum and brass.
And plastic.
There's no end. Plastic is now, and we've already seen the slippery slope take place. Trump has also invoked the fentanyl emergency, which almost exclusively comes from smuggling out of the Mexican drug cartels, but he's used it against Canada, which there's almost no fentanyl coming into the United States.
He said,
because of this imaginary emergency with Canada that comes from a misreading of statistics, intentional, I would dare say, we can impose tariffs on anything and everything from Canada that's completely unrelated to fentanyl, which doesn't even exist as a major problem on the Canadian border. That's the slippery slope we're facing.
So even though a moment ago we floated a little wiggle room idea that the court could use some weasel words to kind of navigate
take it
through,
off
it would be a lot, which would be better than nothing.
Yeah.
But what we really need is the vindication of our constitutional principles. And
a decisive constitutional ruling.
That's what we really need.
No, this is outside of what the Constitution permits. This is a violation of the separation of powers. It's an abuse of emergency action to legislate by fiat. You could have that order. I don't care where you stand on the propriety of tariffs. I'm a free trader. I'm anti-tariff myself. But if you want to enact tariffs, they need to go through the normal course of
enact law. Them by law, exactly.
And make that argument before Congress with the representatives of the people, debate that on the floor of the House and the Senate, and choose what they may. And you know what? The voters will reward or punish them at the next election.
That's right. So we need to stop. This has been a very illuminating conversation. I'm tempted to say to our many friends and viewers, you heard it here first.
Right. we'll see. We may have a ruling very soon. So
yeah. So stay tuned. I'm so grateful to Phil Magnus, who knows the economic angles inside and out. Thank you, Phil, for being willing to talk us through all of this. And thank you, Bill Evers, for giving us the right questions to ask as we went along. I invite our friends, always visit us at independent.org for additional information on this and other topics. You can find writings by Philip Magnus there, as well as by Williamson Evers. Thank you for joining us, everybody. Come back again next time for Independent Outlook. Take care.
Thank you, Graham.